options activity has altered the investment landscape. Get an edge on this massive flow of funds with Tier 1 Alpha's Market Situation Report, brought to you by HedgEye, a daily newsletter of the latest moves in the options market and a weekly webcast featuring myself, Mike Green of Simplify Asset Management, and Tier 1 Alpha's Craig Peterson and David Pegler. Go to HedgEye.com/research for more information.
Hi, I'm HedgEye's founder, Keith McCullough. Thanks for listening to this Real Conversation. If you like what you hear, you will love our investing research. We bring transparency, accountability, and actionable investing ideas to investors big and small. I'll put our investing process and team up against anyone in the world. Please visit HedgEye.com to subscribe and learn a better way to invest. I'm Keith McCullough, and welcome back to another Real Conversation. It's the first one, actually, of 2024. I'm excited to do that with one of the world's best, and Daniel Lecaille. Welcome, Daniel. I know it's a little later for you on your side of the world, but we appreciate you making the time.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure. And no, it's perfectly fine. We like late hours here, so it's not a problem whatsoever.
Well, I'm going to try to, I'll get you fired up. I know, you know, if you have any family members in and around the house, they might hear dad doing getting excited about certain topics. I mean, one that I want to go, and in no certain order, I want to cover a couple compare and contrasts here. One, markets versus economies, okay? I've had some success with our, you know, HedgEye Nation community lately explaining there's a big difference between the two, and being right or wrong on either or. I mean, it's certainly a much tougher game than when you and I started playing this many moons ago. Two, capitalism versus socialism. You're, if not the world's best on that topic, you've been writing about it most recently, coming out of my favorite place on the earth, Davos. Which I'll never get invited to. and finally, I want to talk about the difference between inflation that sticks and disinflation and your thoughts on that super important topic, obviously. But first on markets versus economies, you and I will go wherever you want to take it. You can take specific economies, you can take all of it, but, you know, pretty big difference, you know, last week in particular, like my early look note earlier this week to start the week was, well, last week there was the uniquely American, you know, bubble in the stock market, and then there was everything else in terms of other markets. But we have all this economic data in between. You want to take that first?
Absolutely. Markets versus the economy is one of the great debates currently, because politicians always try to say, hey, the economy is doing phenomenally because, look, markets are actually rewarding our policies.
Right.
But it's been a long time since the market has actually discounted what the real economy is doing. And it's very simple. The level of impact of monetary policy after the monster liquidity injections and negative real rates plus the quantitative easing processes, all of those have generated a completely different market dynamic compared to what we see in the economy, to the point where you and I remember the time in which bad economic data meant a bad reaction from markets. But now, what we get is when economic data is negative, markets actually get excited because that means more money printing, okay? So this is what we need to understand. There's been very few markets in 2023 that actually reflected the reality of the economy. And the only one actually that did was China, because because monetary policy was contractive at the same time as the economy was contracting. Now, so what we need to understand is that multiple expansion, the level of risk that markets take, are direct consequences of monetary destruction. It's ultimately, it's not necessarily that markets are booming. It is basically that the currency in which those markets are priced is losing value and is losing purchasing power. So that explains why the 60-40 portfolio has died as a means of hedging economic cycles, because bonds and equities are massively correlated, for that reason, for the reason that I just mentioned, the incredible level of impact of central bank policy in markets. Therefore, the reason why we need to pay attention to the real economy and to macroeconomics is because there is a very significant divergence between asset classes, depending on the level of impact of that monetary policy on each stock. No? For example, we have seen at the beginning of 2024, a staggering 20 profit warnings in Europe and about 11 in the United States. The price action in those 20 profit warnings in Europe has been between 10 to 20%, so an average of 10.6% drop on the day of those profit warnings. In the United States, expecting big rate cuts and even quantitative easing, but especially the window of liquidity that banks are accessing, the Federal Reserve continuing to pump liquidity, those 11 profit warnings have generated a drop of less than 6%. And median level. So it shows how important it is to discern fundamentals and to something that you always talk about when I look at your videos, etc., which is how important it is to avoid traps in an environment in which you need to be aware of the monetary excess as a driver of markets, but you need to also be aware that there are very large traps when you look at the composition of what drives performance in markets. In the case of the S&P 500, the seven fantastic ones, no, things like that. But it's also important to remember in this case that when we look at the macroeconomic environment, usually what happens is that investors look at markets, they see that markets are going up, they understand that valuations are expensive and that the drivers of that performance are actually the ones that are seeing the largest multiple expansion. However, what I think is also very relevant is that the dangerous thing, and then the reason why you have to pay attention to macroeconomics, is to then decide to put your money in the most cyclical stocks or in the most cyclical assets, because then you get something like what happened in 2023. You suddenly see, oh my God, why are commodities dropping like a stone? Well, those do reflect a more significant element of the reality of the industrial production. So what we're seeing, 23, was, if you divide the year in three, we had a period in which net liquidity in markets was going higher, and that drove multiple expansion. Then net liquidity started to drop, and that generated a correction. And finally, in the last part of the year, a huge recovery in markets that actually drove it back to all-time highs, precisely driven by massive liquidity injections. So the important thing also is to avoid the narrative of believing that central banks are being hawkish. A couple of rate hikes is not being hawkish. What we have seen is what it is to be hugely accommodative.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating too. Like when you look at the expectation of net liquidity improving versus maybe not being on time. Like, let's just start, you know, the year, for example, in the U.S., there was a 97% chance Wall Street was trying to price in of a rate cut by March. Now that's a coin toss. You, of course, are very well aware of the ECB's, you know, at least trying to talk to timing that's closer to the second quarter on the first cut or whatever. But markets, like if you, the market that, you know, you're in Spain today, are you not? Or tonight for you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you look we look at the EBEX, for example, it peaked in April, really, you know, in the second quarter of last year, collapsing until all of a sudden bond yields in Europe stopped going up. Then you had this, to your point, vertical climb. The DAX looks the exact same thing. So there was a point, you know, where you actually were making money on the short side of European equities as Europe entered an actual recession. Right. Most people listening to this are watching this in the U.S. and they don't even know about these things because nobody on other channels talks about these things. But you know, nobody talks about the U.S. industrial recession that they have because they don't want to talk about it. But these things actually happened. The Chinese recession that started, of course, and to your point, that stock market did nothing but hit three-year lows, which was frustrating to them, and they're trying to bail that out with something now. But how, to me, wasn't that, well, to me, first of all, it was very different in the sense that when I say this uniquely American, like MM7, magnificently manipulated seven stocks, you know, through the flow of the machine into options expiration, short-term options, like we can see that. You and I worked in Chicago on the buy side. We know what's going on, you know, but to see that happen in Europe, you know, on these European equities to me was a little breathtaking. I mean, suffice to say, the move in the DAX was breathtaking. So what did you think about that, where European equity markets all of a sudden went vertical as the data got worse? Did that surprise you at all? Because now they're breaking down again.
Well, it surprised me in the severity and the aggressiveness of that bounce. No? Mm-hmm. But if you think about it, obviously, we learn every day in markets, which is the beauty of markets, no, is that they always humble you. But what is interesting is that what happened in Europe was also very similar to what was happening all over the U.S. stock main stock indices. It's not the S&P 500 and the Nasdaq, is that the divergence between stocks was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. For example, you just mentioned the IBEX and the DAX. The largest components of the IBEX, the DAX, were actually the drivers of the recovery in such a huge way. But if you look at, for example, large components, and those are not large number of stocks type of indices. They have 35, 50. Yep. It's not a lot of, there's not a lot of names. It's not a 500 name. But if you look at it, virtually 10% of the stocks actually drove the entire performance. Yep. No? And there were actually others that dropped like a stone. No, which comes back to the point that you were just mentioning, is that fundamentals, the recession, were actually working on the stocks that were less akin to long duration assets. No, mm-hmm. And when was that working in a different way? Obviously, in long duration assets, and in those that were more similar to long term bonds, which actually rallied at the same time. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, if you had a portfolio of U.S. winners, a portfolio of the European winners, you'd still have made quite a significant amount of money, both in the period of traction and in the period of recovery. So I think that what surprised me was the level of aggressiveness of the bounce, considering that at the same time earnings estimates were coming down, and that at the same time the macroeconomic environment was worsening. But obviously, and interestingly enough, that the European Central Bank, unlike the Bank of Japan, was actually saying that there was virtually no chance in hell that they would start cutting rates very, very soon. But we always have to look at more details. And think about it. Why did the IBEX suddenly go through the roof? Who was the biggest beneficiary of this completely obscene concept of the anti-fragmentation tool, which is basically to disguise risk? No? Spain and Italy. So obviously, Spain and Italy went through the roof because the ECB to this day says that they are in a sort of hawkish position, but they continue to purchase Spanish and Italian bonds when those Spanish and Italian bonds are maturing. When the Dutch or the German are paying back their debts. So basically, it's a system. It's a perverse incentive system by which you basically benefit those that don't reduce debt, by using the proceeds of those that actually are making their homework and doing their homework and reducing their imbalances. It's absolutely incredible.
Well, I mean, that's a nice segue to the second topic, socialism versus capitalism. I mean, and we do have, I am long, full disclosure, I am long something in Europe. I am long that Dutch election, the Dutch stock market. There is a difference politically, which you can agree with. Actually, I'm not asking a question on the politics, but I mean, the difference, let's just start with that. Let's start with the difference, and you've been writing about it more specifically these days. I've been citing our old friend who is rolling in his grave, Milton Friedman, of course. You know, people don't want to talk about Milton Friedman. Now, in the U.S., they want to talk about, they don't want to talk about MMT, they just want to do MMT. I mean, this was the biggest surprise in my model ever on government spending. It was a third of GDP growth last year. It was a third of hiring, and people are like, oh, see, there's no recession because we just borrowed all the numbers. Yeah, we borrowed from your future, and it's going to be fine. You know, it's like, so can we go there? You can use the U.S., you can use the Dutch, you can use the Germans, you can use whatever you want to use.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's start to understand why it is bad to disguise a private sector recession with monster government spending and bloated and bloated debt. No, the first reason is because it gives the idea to governments that their policies are working when they're actually not. And you've just mentioned a very important piece of data. One third of the growth came from the public expenditure. But if you actually look at the GDP growth of the United States, excluding the accumulation of debt, it was the worst year since 1930. It's incredible that, no? So then you look at what the Congressional Budget Office or other bodies do, and then they look at the potential growth of the United States for the following decades. And they're talking about half of the potential economic growth of the past decade. So basically, borrowing to disguise recession, the only thing that it does is to make the next year's worse in terms of economic growth, certainly in terms of productivity growth, in terms of real wage growth, because even if there is some disinflation, obviously real wages are actually not improving. So all of the elements that we consider as elements that measure prosperity get significantly worse and evidently worse. So public debt is not, as the MMT crowd say, assets for the private sector, no, or reserves for the private sector. No, it's not reserves for the private sector. It's a burden on growth, and it's a burden that means more taxes, lower growth, lower job growth, and certainly lower real wage growth in the future. And you look at the United States that still has a dynamic economy, and you say, well, it doesn't look that bad, no? But I come from the future, my friends. I'm in Europe. My dear American friends, you know, when I go to Argentina, Argentine citizens tell to us that they come from the future, but I come from your future. I come from the future in which you will see, in which you will see that all this horse crap about spending and entitlement program and huge debt doesn't matter because it's always going to be refinanced and the Fed is always going to monetize it, etc., ends with no growth, no real wage growth, and higher unemployment. In the United States, you still have low unemployment. But think about this. A few decades ago, the United States and the what now is the euro area had a very similar level of unemployment rate and a very similar level of economic growth. It's been less than 30 years, actually. Yes, less than 30 years in which those two trends have moved in opposite directions. No? And another example, if you want to put it in the same economic area, is France versus Germany. France and Germany actually had very, very similar trends of growth and productivity and employment. And France decided to go the path of massive public expenditure and huge increase in public sector employment. And Germany decided to go down the route, of spending cuts and what they now call austerity. And the paths are completely divergent. And everybody says now, yes, oh, but Germany is in a recession. Hold on a second. Any European wants to have a recession like the German one in a growth period, which means with very, very low unemployment and much higher real wages, and obviously much better levels of productivity. So ultimately, the problem of socialism versus capitalism is very simple, is that socialism denies the economic calculus. Yeah, socialism is defending that 2 + 2 = 22, and that there is no problem in massively increasing the imbalances of the state because those don't generate problems in the future. And people tend to say, well, there's no socialism. It's not socialism, because socialism is the productive means in the hands of the state. And that's not the case in the United States, and it's not the case in the euro area. Well, that's not the definition of socialism. And the real definition of socialism, which Huerta de Soto and others showed, is the collective attack on private ownership and private entrepreneurship from a group of from a collective of individuals in power. That is what we're having. And that, both through massive taxation, completely in unnecessary regulation and legislation, huge printing of money, manipulation of the currency and manipulation of interest rates, is socialism. Because ultimately, if you think about the total effects of all those things, what they basically do is to massively give a privilege to the state control by making governments pay less for their borrowing than private entrepreneurs and families, by making access to credit privilege to states, and also by bloating the size of government well above its revenue generation abilities. So what the risk is that it when it's a slow process, it seems that nothing is happening. And people think that nothing is happening, but they don't understand why there is a strong economy, but their wages in real terms aren't growing. They think that there is a strong economy, but they don't understand why their small business has less of a chance of becoming a big business than when their parents or their grandparents started their own businesses. They think that nothing is happening, but their ability to reach the end of the month is worse despite an allegedly strong economy. All those things are, you're basically slowly making a nationalization of the economy. And the reason why it doesn't work is because it denies that the reason why capitalism works is because it's a system in which the unit, the economic agent that makes a mistake, suffers the impact of that mistake, and creative destruction generates prosperity and improvement in the economy. So all of that is rewarding the productivity and rewarding the improvement in the economic conditions for the majority of the population, and penalizing those that do things improperly. Socialism is the opposite. Mm-hmm. Socialism is a system by which what you're basically doing is penalizing those that succeed in order to generate a perverse incentive for those that live off those who succeed. And therefore, as the number of people that live off those who produce outnumber the number of people that produce, then the concept of redistribution, which is ludicrous, stupid, because wealth is not a pie that is sitting in the fridge. Wealth is either created or destructive, and there's nothing in between. And governments, the state, does not generate wealth. The government consumes wealth. That's fine. We accept that there is a portion of the wealth created in the economy that the state is going to consume in order to administer to improve the social ladder. But when that piece gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and instead of improving the social ladder, what it's doing is basically rewarding unproductive activities and bloating administration and bureaucracy, then the entire process of economic growth and prosperity is destroyed. And the level of wealth creation every year is lower, lower and weaker. And therefore, there is less both for the ones that produce, and certainly less in real terms for those that live off those who produce. The key of socialism is that even if you are in the side of those that benefit from the government destruction of the productive sector, even if you are between among them, you will also lose in real terms in your salary, in your savings, and in your ability to improve your condition.
Very well put, and professorial. I mean, you basically had me laughing out loud with the "I am from the future" joke, because you know that's the thing about the best jokes are the ones that are the most truthful. And on that subject matter, I mean, it's an amazing thing, isn't it? Everybody's long NVIDIA loves AI, but they can't remember the past. Never mind, you know, look ahead to the future. I mean, I'm not kidding you. I mean, most people have no idea who this guy is. I mean, Milton Friedman, his caricature, his stance, which would not reflect everything that you said or agree with everything you said, and you wouldn't agree with everything that he said or wrote. It was born out of, you know, these sticky inflation. Let's go back to the cowbell in the 1970s. Arthur Burns was his friend, and he called him out and he said, "Look, it doesn't work. It's an empirical fact." And you know, then you had the political leadership that was born out of those years, and whether it was Thatcher or it was Reagan, and it, again, whatever people's politics are today, like these are, you know, the output of socialism economically. It is a funny joke because it's funny and it's true. 2 + 2 = 22. I mean, and if you want to disguise it as success because the stock market's up, I mean, that's the new way to do it. But I have five slides, Daniel. I'll try to get just to put some meat on the bone, because most socialists don't speak in numbers. They speak in narratives, right? You know, the Communist Manifesto itself starts with pinning people against each other as classes. You know, I'm from a working family in Thunder Bay, Ontario, Canada. I guess my dad didn't make that much money, but we weren't part of a class. Like, you know, I didn't live next to a castle in 15th century, you know, Britain. It's not the real world, right? But these are things that have been part of the narrative for a long, long time. And so has bloating the debt and spending taxpayer money at the deficit level. So just to show these, I'm going to show these five slides quickly, and then you can go off on that. But guys, if you go on the current slide deck, jump ahead to the big G, the deficit and debt spending debt, where we have slide 107. 106. So 106 is just showing you, which you well know, Daniel, but again, $34 trillion amongst friends. You know, that's only grown $5.7 trillion or 500%, you know, since the start of 2000, okay? So these are the numbers, right? That is part of what actually happened. If you want to see the debt clock on the next slide, in 13 weeks, it's already gone up $900 billion, okay? And I know that's, you know, amongst friends that don't want to talk in numbers, but they want to disguise, as Daniel says, disguise policy as working. Well, there's a big thing that's going on that's allegedly making it working, and it's that. And then you have the deficit chart, which is the next one. So, and this is using CBO projections, which never predict a recession, which is hilarious in its own right. But, you know, this is supposed to exceed over $2.5 trillion in 8 years, Daniel. So, like that is the future. And then finally on this last slide, two more slides, 109, this is a really interesting time. Like, if you read the left side, I'll read it for people just so you know, people understand the difference between deficit spending with the unemployment rate this low, and we're talking about deficit as a percentage of GDP. It's unprecedented. Like, this chart shows you, since 1948, there have only been 7 years with larger deficits as a percentage of GDP. Okay, what happened in those seven years? Well, those 7 years saw either titanic dislocations due to exogenous events, recessions, or were years marked by extremely high employment thereafter. So, then finally we show today though, because that last, let's toggle back and forth. That's the history, but today, the jobs are there today because of this slide 110, where, as I pointed out, public sector jobs as a percentage of the payroll gains in this case were a quarter of them. So isn't that amazing relative to what you said? I am from the future, right?
Yeah.
All historical backtests, all empirical realities from Milton on Friedman to anybody who's studied this, you can look it up on ChatGPT right now yourself. You know, all we're talking about is success in the past, but those very things that I just showed, do they not guarantee that you are from the future?
Oh, they absolutely do. They absolutely do. Think about the amazing chart that you just showed, which I think that should be in every school in the United States today, which is unemployment to deficit, no?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then the massive level of deficit that the CBO projects. But think about this. The Biden administration itself expects the U.S. deficit to be, without any recession, an accumulated $14 trillion between 2023 and 2032, okay? An accumulated $14 trillion. So what this tells you is the difference between creating jobs and subsidizing jobs with newly printed money. What is a deficit? What is a deficit? People think that a deficit is, well, people don't know what a deficit is. There's, I think, 60% of the population in developed economies that don't know what a deficit is. But a deficit basically is that when the government spends more than it collects in taxes, what it is basically doing is printing money. It is literally consuming newly created units of currency. Okay? Those units of currency generate two types of inflation. One is inflation of debt, which is what we're seeing in the United States, because the United States can finance their debt. The other, if you cannot finance your debt, is printing, and therefore massive inflation in consumer prices immediately. But the two effects are exactly the same, only sort of postponed over time. If that deficit was generated by the United States in an environment in which it could not finance its debt, it would generate immediately a massive level of inflation. As it can finance its debt, that inflation is sort of postponed over time, but the destruction of the purchasing power of your wages and your deposit savings is impossible to stop, is actually unstoppable, no? So what people need to understand is that when the government tells you that deficits are a tool for growth, what they're actually telling you is that they are a tool for maintaining the level of repression on wages and on savings on citizens. Because the government doesn't suffer the consequences of that deficit. I guarantee you that in this election, this government will go to citizens saying that the concept of Bidenomics has worked phenomenally, and an important factor here, and I prefer to put something in this. A lot of people think socialism left wing. No, as Hayek used to say, beware of the right wing socialists. Those that do exactly the same, but tell you that they are pro market and pro free trade. Because socialism is not about about an ideology. Socialism is about advancing the power of the state over the parts of the economic agents that produce. That is it. Mm-hmm. And it can be done by a right wing or by a left wing government. So the way in which they basically sell you that this is a that this problem is because of one ideology or the other is the following. People will look at the deficit and one side will tell you, oh, that is because of the tax cuts. And the other will tell you, oh, that is because of the stupid Inflation Reduction Act that didn't reduce inflation and didn't reduce the actually the deficit increased it. The reality of a deficit is that it is always a spending problem. It is always a spending problem. Why? Because revenues, receipts, are always cyclical. Always. So when a government increases, sees revenues increase, and then decides to increase expenditure, it is already creating the pillars of the debt problem in the future, because it gets used to these revenues. Then, as you very well mentioned, all of those projections have zero recessions in 30, 50 years. There's never going to be a recession. So just not even a recession. Look at December numbers of the budget of the tax receipts in the United States. December in the United States was a decline in tax receipts in the United States, $125 billion deficit. So it's always a spending problem because spending is accumulated, annualized, and obviously new programs are presented and nobody does a zero budget, no? And receipts are cyclical. So there's no concept of a sort of revenue reducing measure that is going to reduce the deficit. Come back to your slide. 2.3 trillion annual deficit. There is no revenue measure, none whatsoever, not even if suddenly the United States finds, I don't know, gold under the ground everywhere to start with, because if it found gold under the ground and started to produce it, gold would go down. But it doesn't matter. The problem is that there is absolutely no revenue measure that would bring that deficit to zero. And bringing the deficit to zero would still leave you with 34 trillion of debt. So how does all of that match? By destroying the purchasing power of the currency. So every time that the government tells you that something is free, what they're telling you is that you, your children and your grandchildren are going to pay for it. Ronald Reagan said it. He said that the inflation is the price of the things that the government told you were for free.
Yeah. Let's get to that third topic, then, the difference between. Because again, unless you show me, like, well, first of all, if you show me deflation, the other side of that trade, you get a lot of different things, including a stock market crash. But actual year-over-year declines in prices, as opposed to disinflating the highest levels of inflation last seen in the Jimmy Carter era that was perpetuated by, again, okay, so everyone needs and wants a rate cut on Wall Street. Let's use a basic example of what you said is a spending problem on Social Security. Slide 112. I mean, look what this did. Look what the government's COLA adjustment, you know, when you obviously know what that is, but people, and my dad gets what that is. He's a retired firefighter. My mom's a retired teacher. We understand what that is. You know, they got a big adjustment, you know, but now it's just coming down just to go back up again? I mean, let's talk about that. Talk about the cumulative inflation. So, another real-world example I always use on the macro show or with institutional clients, I'm like, oh, that's funny. So you think inflation, it's like George Bush standing on the aircraft, you know, deck saying, you know, victory is here or whatever. I mean, the victory that they are trying to declare on inflation to any human being that isn't loaded, like in the top 10% of income earners in America, is a fucking joke. I mean, it's like the cost of my living versus where it was 3 years ago. Inflation's cumulative. And if the catalyst is to cut rates to get inflation, you know, when you cut interest rates, you devalue the purchasing power further of the dollar and that thing goes back up. This happened three times in the 1970s. And allegedly Powell said he didn't want to see that happen again. But the minute that Wall Street begged for these rate cuts, he pretty much signed off on them or tried to. So I know there's a lot in that, but can we just talk about real world inflation versus some disinflation of the most epic inflation anybody on this side of the grass has ever seen.
Okay, the first thing that everybody needs to understand is that the consumer price index is not inflation, it's a measure of inflation. And right. It's a measure of inflation measured by an economic agent that wants inflation to be disguised, obviously. The CPI index was created by an economist called Irving Fisher that went bankrupt three times in his life because the stock market crashed on headlines of bread is up 50% and things like that. No? So what happens then, he said, okay, let's put bread with hotels. Hotels not going up, bread going up 50%. Inflation, CPI, is only up 2%, okay? No? So basically, what happens in the CPI index is that it gives a false narrative of reduction in prices to start with, because the evidence of the data shows us that in December, all prices went up except for four. All prices, no? of the ones that are included in the CPI index, and that people understand inflation much better, obviously, because they see that basically what they have to pay every day only goes up, and what they earn every day only goes down in purchasing power. No? So why is the narrative of rate cuts so dangerous? First, because it is insane looking at the history of money to think that you are going to solve a problem created by the largest and quickest money increase in history, which was between March 2020 and September 2020, that you're going to solve the problem created by that in a year. That makes absolutely no sense. And obviously, because anyone that understands the CPI index understands that the base effect has been the largest component of the so-called reduction. And I always say to my students, if I gain 10 pounds a year, and then in the next year I gain 4 pounds, I'm not getting any thinner. That's the way to understand inflation, no? The prices of goods and services that are services that are in the basket of what we call the non-replaceable goods, those things that you need to pay for every day, no matter what. It's not a choice. Hotels are a choice. Technology is a choice. Those things are the ones that bring down the year-on-year increase in inflation. Energy comes down in the components of energy. However, tell that to, especially to Americans, tell that to Americans if they really have seen a 30% drop in their energy bill, electricity, power, power, gas, and obviously natural gas. So the problem that we find is that in the years in which they said that there was no inflation, the rise in non-replaceable goods and services, so health care, insurance, shelter, etc., all of those were rising much faster than CPI. So the ability of citizens to live day by day was getting worse anyhow. And then even CPI inflation went through the roof because of the insane money growth. And let me just say one thing to people that are looking at it, watching it. Inflation doesn't go up because of oil or because of the supply chains or because of a war. One price may rise because of an exogenous factor, and it may rise throughout a period of time. But if the quantity of money is the same and the velocity of money is the same, that price increase would make the rest of prices decline, not go up. A war doesn't make prices go up, makes most prices go down, because the units of currency that you need to pay for oil are taken away from the units of currency that you have to pay for the rest of goods and services. Furthermore, commodities, supply chain disruptions, etc., may affect CPI in a short period of time, but they don't generate what inflation is, which is an annualized, consolidated, and then increased again level of price. And the only thing that makes aggregate prices go up in unison all the time, consolidate the increase generated by an exogenous factor, and continue to rise, is the issuance of more units of currency than those that are demanded by the productive economy. That is as simple and as complicated as that, is that inflation is not generated by supply chain disruptions or by greedflation, that stupidity invented by statism, etc. So come back to the market. Inflation, real inflation, means the destruction of the purchasing power of the currency. Therefore, not being invested in that environment is not just unadvisable. It's insane, because basically the only way in which you can actually combat inflation is by investing in assets that offset that inflation factor. Rate cuts. It makes no sense for the market to bet on one thing and the opposite at the same time. The market is currently betting on there's going to be 5 to 6 rate cuts, and the economy is going to be in a soft landing. That has never happened in history. No central bank has ever acted preemptively. If central banks cut rates 5 or 6 times in 2024, it will be because the data that they're seeing is a massive reduction in the aggregate demand of the private sector, because we have already established that the aggregate demand of the public sector is not coming down. Okay. So what we're talking is about a huge recession that would drive a rate cut. Be my guest owning cyclical stocks in that scenario. Now, if there is a soft landing, the economy remains relatively stable because of that bloated GDP disguise of debt, etc., and inflation drops on an annualized level, you know, with money supply growth, then there is no chance in hell that central banks are going to cut rates 5 to 6 times. So if you bet on rate cuts, bet on a huge recession. And if you don't bet on a huge recession, don't even think that there's going to be 5 or 6 rate cuts. And the Fed has never in history taken aggressive monetary actions on the amount of money and the cost of money in an election year. On top of all of that, apart from no central bank in history being preemptive and therefore cutting rates before the economic data shows this monster recession that I was mentioning.
Yeah, it's I don't live in you know, La La Land or believe in rainbows and puppy dogs. Like, I mean, it's just, we believe in what the data is actually doing. I think if you're, but again, you're from the future and I have a back. But if you look, if you're from the past and you're looking backwards, Daniel, go to slide 26, guys, on our, this is our GDP Nowcast, right? You know, CNBC would rather, you know, shut the channel down, finally ending the greatest or the longest standing comedy in cable history, than show my numbers on this. But, you know, if you look back at the biggest government spending quarter, which was the third quarter, where you had epic percentage gains in both jobs ads from government and government spending itself, that's your Goldilocks, right? You look backwards. Those are the black reported headline quarter over quarter GDP numbers. I think you can see those, right, Daniel? If you're a person of the future and understand the long term that Daniel's just gone through, the impact of debts, deficits, socialism, et cetera, and you actually have my Nowcast, and you're begging for rate cuts, you're begging for the recession that we already have embedded in our assumptions. And, like, you know, you and I are old enough to remember, and this is my question on this. We're going to, if you have some questions, I think we can get to a couple in the queue, fire them in the queue, and I'll see if there are a couple that we can ask. But there are legions of guys our age, and they're mostly guys, but there are, you know, they finally opened up our profession so that there's a better mix, thank God. But people, you've written about most recently, one of my non-favorites, Zandi, Mark Zandi, totally missed the last recession. All these people have the same thing in common. They work for the government, or in the case of Austin Goolsbee, he's now the head of the Chicago Fed, because they couldn't call their way into and out of a recession if their life depended on it and have never been able to do it. But what they talk about, Austin Goolsbee literally said on the last CPI number that it's been a Hall of Fame year for inflation. Hall of Fame! Like a Hall, I mean the level of arrogance, I mean, it is unbelievable. The people have no voice on this. Like, again, you're from the future. You understand this. Europe's been socialist for far too long. But I'm a Canadian who came to America, and you want to talk to any normal American who doesn't have a voice, which is everyone else. You know, there's the state. There are the elites that feast on the state and all the inside information, all the insider trading. And then there's the rest of us, right? So the rest of us are like, Hall of Fame year for inflation. What? Like, what? And they say it every single day.
Yeah. And I read from, I think it was Paul Krugman that said that it was a massive success to bring down inflation to 4% with this. And this is, think about what government spending is doing to inflation. Okay. You've had an absolutely phenomenal decline in money supply growth. It's negative year on year in 2023. Which should have meant, and think about this, if you look at the reality of the economy, this should have meant that inflation should have dropped to 1.5% immediately in 2023, considering the base effect, okay? 1.5, it's double that. It's double that. So the Hall of Fame success, inflation that they're talking about is a monster 22% inflation, accumulated inflation in a period in which technology disinflation should have helped to produce more goods and services and improve productivity, in which you've had a lockdown, in which you've had all of those factors should have been hugely disinflationary. And what they're talking about, Hall of Fame level of inflation, is a 22-23% accumulated inflation in a few years. This is absolutely insane. And I come back to the point for people to understand this. Why does technology and technology giants generate positive disinflation for citizens? On the one hand, they generate massive improvements of productivity and improvements of access to goods and services to everybody. That's fine. But the most important thing is the monster level of cash generation that technology giants generate actually help offset the monster increase in deficit spending of the government. So in that environment, to say that an inflation, year-on-year inflation, that is double what it should have been considering the monetary aggregates and the velocity of money is basically... it's basically trying to fool people. By the way, because we're old, particularly me, and I lived stagflation, I remember when people were writing headlines of saying, great reduction in inflation after an 11% inflation year. Of course, there's a big reduction in inflation the year after an 11%. And then what happens the next? And this is the problem. The problem is you can't not bake the cake and eat. If inflation is going to be reduced, it needs a massive reduction in aggregate demand. The aggregate demand of the public sector is not dropping. Therefore, there's either a public sector contraction, which is not likely to happen, or what we will likely see is the concept of a soft landing, which is what I always call, and what is happening, which is a private sector recession.
Yeah, this is. I mean, look at
the manufacturing sector. It's an
absolute. That's. I say this all the time too. I'm like, because okay, let's just say you're just you know, this Austin Goolsbee, right? Completely useless. Everybody, you know, a guy used to work for Obama. He's politicized, obviously. he's going to tell you the narrative you need to hear politically. He's not going to actually review the data. Whenever I say, hey, look, you know, there are many people in this business. By the way, Daniel was at Citadel, I believe, during the Big Bang. 08 recession, were you on the buy side or no?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, oh my God.
So they're buy-siders that got it right. There are very few people that write research every day like me who, you know, it's not like I'm going to hide that I got it right. You're in, you know, if you get something like that right, you should talk a little bit about it. And if you have no experience other than getting it dead wrong, like Austin Goolsbee and all these econs did when inflation went from 2 to 4 to 9, even on their bullshit CPI number, like, I don't know why people put their full faith and credit in it. They really don't know what these people are talking about really anyway. And again, it's just narrative. But when you think about this, like look at slide 111 here on monthly. This is actually what, so the stock market, follow me here, month to month to month. Now, it was egregious, but in October, it was beyond egregious. See that? 58%. Now, what happened between the end of the summer and October? The Russell 2000 drew down or crashed 18%. Even S&P 500 and these Mag 7 stocks went down, right? So they really needed to change the narrative, because when the elites are losing money, that becomes a bigger problem, right? So the state needed to get a line. A lot of people are confused on when net liquidity was provided. It was certainly provided there, and that's not deflationary, you know, because you're creating a government job that now all of us in the private sector, to your point, have to compete with, right? My brother is a McDonald's franchisee. Mm-hmm. He doesn't pay people, you know, what he used to, not even close. He has to compete with that.
Yeah.
Right? And when you say private sector, and this is the full circle I was going to say on none of these people called any of the last two recessions. You know, so again, we've been on the right side of it. This recession is not like 08. 08 was driven by Wall Street leverage. What you're saying, I think, and I say it all the time, this is a Main Street recession.
This Absolutely. Is a,
You look at the NFIB surveys, which again, 99% of U.S. companies are not publicly listed Mag 7s. You know, they're actually not in a recession. To be clear, they're in a depression.
Exactly.
I mean, so we're like really at
exactly,
this point
exactly.
where it kind of, I mean, shouldn't just frustrate me. I think the people with a capital T and a capital P really are looking for a voice on this.
Oh, absolutely they are. We need to understand, you've mentioned a very important concept, buy side versus sell side. The sell side sells, which is, you know, it's perfectly legitimate. No problem there. That's what it does.
Yep.
And have you ever heard a government say the economy is a disaster? Never. Well, Milei in Argentina, but obviously because it's so painfully obvious. No? But have you ever heard a government say there's going to be a massive, heard an investment bank say there's going to be a massive recession? No, they are selling an environment that in which obviously they are giving their own views, and we give our views, and you know, and no problem with that. But you need to understand the difference between sell side and buy side, and the reason why the buy side gets it right is because there is more skin in the game, and I think that is an absolutely relevant factor. But I think that there's also one problem in economics that we have found. Now, and Roma, of all people, Nobel Prize winner, etc., many people have actually pointed it out, is the stupidity of models, is the imbecility of models, is that these people use models and they say, oh, our model says that if we print $20 trillion in 4 months, there's not going to be any inflation because our model says that everything else remaining equal, inflation will not rise. Everything else remaining equal, what the hell are you talking about? And the problem of macroeconomics is that it has become a way to try to provide a scientific explanation to the narrative. not to analyze the data and to find different outcomes. And the reason why they don't change is because they are not subject to the rule of price, and they don't care what prices say. Price action is the most important factor. So the models are stupidity. It's completely ridiculous to come out and say that our model in macroeconomics, not the models that we use that are using actual data and that look at year-on-year trend changes, but the models that try to predict the outcome of an economy by making all elements remaining equal and one changing, because things don't change one at a time. So that's the problem of macroeconomics. And the trouble with macroeconomics is that it has become so embedded in the idea that it has to justify any and every government and public sector imbalance that it loses the credibility. So that is one problem. But the other problem, I think, is that you have just is that looking at the market, the market is driven by 500 companies in the United States, out of which 7 dictate the performance of the market. I mean, just from the perspective of analyzing the economy, that in itself negates why you should put together the market with the economy. But you've mentioned one thing that's very important. The 90% of companies that are not quoted, if you look at year-on-year growth in revenues and the tax receipts of those companies, you are actually in, you mentioned it, not a recession, a depression. If you look at the average consumption in real terms, in an economy that is allegedly growing fast with very low unemployment, consumption in real terms is showing you that excluding those elements that are absolutely necessary, there's no real growth in consumption. So investment is in decline. Huh? So, and GDP is helped by a lower figure of imports. So all of those things disguise the reality. But in an economy in which the government weighs between 39% to 59% in some countries, insane, to a market in which 50 to 100 companies dictate the entire performance, it doesn't tell you anything about what is happening in the sales of small businesses and in the wages of the average citizen. And that is why then the same people that make an analysis and say, hey, the economy is doing phenomenally, the government has done a great job, policy is working, et cetera, then say, oh, how could there be that this outsider or this candidate that nobody expected to win goes out and wins, because people do feel it. The rise of populism is the effect of an economy in which the aggregates are leaving behind the average citizen and the average business, which is not as an S&P 500. Company and the average citizen, which is not you or I or any of the ones that are watching us right now. So that is the problem.
Yeah, if anything, I mean, like I always joke, I mean, when you're starting to look at, like today, it'll be well north of it, but on up days, like 0 days to expiration, trading volume on S&P 500 options that close within 7 hours of the open, because that's how long the day is. Mm. You know, that's like where Daniel and I used to work. That's Chicago. That's not little, you know, that's not the small business owner, you know, in the hood in Cleveland who's running the corner store. It's not little Johnny or Janet's sister's brother. And by the way, like, that's a big game where the rich are getting richer. And I got no problem with people getting rich. It's just really all this kind of comes back, and we have to wrap this up. We could go on and on and on. I mean, I cited, you know, the Peter Turchin book is called End Times, right? And Somewhere in between, or if you read End Times by Peter Turchin, or if you read my partner's book, The Fourth Turning Is Here by Neil Howe, it's all the same.
What a great book.
Yeah. And this is, and if you don't have time to read, a lot of people don't like to read. That's why narratives are so powerful, because it takes no experience. It takes no knowledge to believe anything. I mean, that's the power of where we are today in terms of the social media lens. But if you actually take the time to read, or if you listen to Neil's book, he reads it himself, you will really come to understand that there is end times is a thing, right? Generational fourth turning, the political power, the elites embedded therein, it's a thing. It's happened historically always. So it's a real interesting time to have had this discussion, I think, because the only time that these super long-term factors matter, like debts, deficits, socialism, is when the cycle actually slows into a recession, and even they have to say, oh, shit. Oh, shit.
Yeah.
You know, that I think that that's going to be a moment if we're right, like, we'll see. Our now cast, unlike these linear econs, is stochastic. You know how proprietary it is in nature. If the numbers start to go up, then our numbers are going to go up. If the numbers start to go down, they're going to go down. So it's stochastic in nature. In other words, it takes incoming data, not just one input, and say this is all else equal. That's ridiculous. I mean, I just think it's going to be a very interesting year for people who can maybe come back to remembering that the gravity of the economy actually matters. So, Thank you for all your knowledge. We could go on and on and on, but I said I'd keep it at an hour, and I'm now at an hour and 6 minutes. Which, like I said, I'd do it for 2 hours and 6 minutes. I'd do it for 3 hours and 6 minutes because he's Daniel Licata. So thank you very much, Daniel, for educating people on some critical topics.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Gosh, an hour and 6 minutes. I thought it had been 20 minutes. So I enjoyed it enormously. And for all of those that want to read something that they find something to come back to, I always recommend Economic Facts and Fallacies by Thomas Sowell, because that is not a book that you need to read from start to finish in a year or in a month or in a couple of weeks, but you can use as a guide from time to time. So I always recommend that one, apart from mine, very cheap and very affordable.
Your books? Yeah, he reads a lot of books, see behind him, and he's written a lot of books. So again, if you want to dig into any of the topics where it may have, you know, how people are like, oh, it seems like that guy knows what he's talking about. Yeah. And he's a practitioner, which is very different than some bookworm and their linear econ stuff. So again, he's got both. He's got both covered. I like to think I do too, but he's a lot better than I am. So look up his books and educate yourself. That's the best thing you can do, and pretty much the only thing you can do. So thanks for spending the time with Daniel and I on a real conversation. It was the first one of the year, and I wanted to have one to remember, and I think we will. Thanks for joining us.
Don't forget to check out Hedgeye.com to get more actionable investing insights from our team of more than 40 research analysts. And check us out on Twitter at our handle, @Hedgeye. This presentation is informational only. None of the information contained herein constitutes an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security or investment vehicle, nor does it constitute investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice by Hedgeye or any of its employees, officers, agents, or guests. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. This content is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. Hedgeye is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual expressing those opinions and conclusions and are intended solely for the use of Hedgeye subscribers and the authorized recipients of the contents. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information contained herein is protected by United States and foreign copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient. Access must be provided directly by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited. For more detail, please refer to the terms of service at hedgeye.com/terms of service.